he's bowled him round his legs. Bowled him round his legs. Well, that's 10 for the match for Stuart McGill. In this innings, 5 for 47. And he must be very happy with the way things are going.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, a.k.a. Menners, and you just heard the sound of our guest today taking his 10th wicket in the 1998-99 Ashes series. He took 208 test wickets for Australia at an average of 29 at a better strike rate than Shane Warne. I'm talking, of course, of Stuart McGill. Welcome to the show, Stuart. How are you?
G'day, Andrew. I'm excellent.
It must be good memories thinking back to that test in 1998-99. I was there. You took 12 for... I guess that was the time you kind of announced yourself at international cricket.
Yeah, look, I don't know about memories because I'm starting to find it more and more difficult to remember that sort of thing. But that was my first test match at the SCG, which is where I'd made my home after moving from Perth. So it was quite a big game for me just, I guess, for that reason alone, let alone the fact that it was a pretty important one for the series for Australia against England. So, yeah, look, I loved playing here and, you know, obviously I played most of my cricket here in the end.
Yeah, I actually met you not long after that test match when Cricket Australia or the SCG Trust, I'm not sure, gave you the use of a private box to celebrate you getting 12 wickets. And I came to a one-day game. I know it was definitely with Tim Farris, the In Excess guitarist. I'm just dropping names here. And he said, look, let's go up to McGill's box.
Yeah.
And you were celebrating the 12 wickets. And that really was a special performance. Did you feel like that's when you belonged in Australian test side?
Look, it certainly helps. I think for any team at any level, you really, well, as a bowler, you really need to get some wickets under your belt to feel as though, you know, you're capable of making some headway, because it's all about wickets. I've said to spin bowlers and fast bowlers alike over the years, if you're in the team and you're just managing to keep the run rate down, when your team loses, if you haven't got the wickets in the wicket column, they are going to look at you even if you're very economical. They're going to look at you and eventually you will get replaced, which is sometimes not fair because there's lots of bowlers who are asked to do a job of just bowling dots and getting through the overs. But my warning to all of them is that you will be the first one discarded if your team doesn't win matches. And quite often that's because the batsmen aren't making any runs. But I needed to get wickets every game for my own sort of personal state of mind. And, you know, taking 12 in that match meant that I could win matches for my team. And I was the leading wicket taker in the series as well, which meant that I'd been able to do it consistently too, and I think that was quite important, you know, in terms of moving to the next step, you know, and the next team, because I would also get very, very nervous if I hadn't got a batsman out before. So, you know, it wouldn't have mattered if it was you or Don Bradman bowling to, and I am suggesting, Andrew, that you're not Don Bradman. But it was the first time I bowled to someone. It was difficult for me until I got you out once, and then I'd just relax and you'd become just another faceless batsman.
Yeah, and I think in that game you certainly outperformed Shane Warne and maybe out-bowled him. Was that sort of something important to you or didn't?
No, I can sort of pretty much just knock it on the head there, actually. Never really competed with any other bowlers, to be honest. I think maybe that was a strength of mine. I was pretty good. I worked out that if I worried about other people, then my own performances would suffer. And so I'd go about my own business. It certainly helped having bowlers like Shane Warne and Glenn McGrath at the other end. Don't get me wrong. And Jason Gillespie, for that matter, and later on Brett Lee. But, you know, because if you have them up the other end, then your job's a lot easier. But I never really cared about whether I got more wickets than other people, provided I contributed to the 20 wickets that my team needed to win the game.
Yeah, you know, just sitting here looking at you, I can see you've got really big forearms. you know, they must have really helped get that prodigious turn on the ball. You know, you used to give the ball such a rip, forearm, fingers.
Yeah, look,
arthritis now?
Yeah, oh, look, I've got huge problems with my fingers. You know, I have trouble sort of the top knuckle up in both hands, actually. I sort of have not much feeling at all, but, you know, it's a shame, actually. I mean, that's in the end, that's what stopped me from playing, which was really quite disappointing for me because I'd kind of wanted to keep playing for a couple of years. And I'd never played a test match in England, never played a test match in South Africa, never played a test match in India, never played a test match in New Zealand. And if I'd played for two more years, I'd have done all of those things. So I was really, really keen to take that, you know, next step because, you know, they were uncharted territories for me. But the in terms of physical sort of, I guess, ability or physical genetics, kind of lucky my dad and my grandfather were sort of both pretty well put together. And
they both played first-class cricket, is that right?
Grandpa and my dad, so Charlie was my grandpa and Terry was my dad. They both played for Western Australia. And they're both pretty big blokes, I guess. And also the other thing is we got in the gym pretty early from, you know, an early age. So, you know, doing weight training from, you know, I think 13 was when my dad let me start getting in the gym. And at one stage when I was at the Cricket Academy, I'd sort of be doing weights 6 days a week. So I think it probably does make a bit of a difference. Mm. And I think it also makes a difference in terms of how much your workload you can cope with. I think if you bowl half the overs, you're a fair chance of getting half the wickets, and you can only do that if you've got the stamina and the strength to be able to get by. And so I'm sure the years of weight training helped.
Yeah. Now you mentioned your grandfather. I heard you tell a story about when you met Don Bradman in the lead up to the first test. I mean, meeting Bradman must have been a special occasion, but then he said something to you that probably made it even more special.
Yeah. Look, I like food, as you can see. But what we'd normally do is whenever we went to any place, really, have a look to see what the best restaurants around were, and we'd try and go to at least one of them during the match. And it was in Adelaide, and we went to a restaurant called Jama's in Kensington. I'm not sure if it's still there now, but it was at the end of day one of the first of my first test. It was the third test against South Africa in Adelaide in 98. And
were you replacing Warnie? Was he injured?
No, I was playing with Warnie. I was actually replacing Paul Rifle. I think he had a broken finger. So I was replacing Paul Rifle. And at the end of that day, we went to the restaurant and Dad said, oh, you know, look, that's Bradman over there, sitting in there. And I just sort of thought, well, first of all, I was pretty tired, to be honest, at the end of day one. But secondly, I just sort of thought, oh, I don't want to bug him at dinner because I'm too cool to do that.
Well, it's a hard thing to do anyway.
Well, maybe, yeah. And I remember growing up and Dennis Lilly's a friend of the family and you know, people always used to bother him while he was having dinner and it must have just driven him out. Well, it drove me nuts and I was just a kid. But as Bradman was walking out of the restaurant, I thought, oh, you know, I'll chase him. And my grandfather had played against Bradman in the, I think, maybe the 50s and, you know, got him out. Certainly after the Second World War anyway, but got him out and made 70-odd in the first innings. So he opened the batting and bowling for WA, which was pretty cool. I think he was a chucker, though, which is even cooler.
sort of.
Yeah, it's really cool. I like that, yeah. Like, everybody likes to have a convict in the family. Well, I haven't got that, but I've got a chucker. I, you know, decided that I was going to chase Bradman out of the restaurant just because I thought, well, look, you know, it's your first test. If you meet Don Bradman as well, it's sort of another thing that's cool about it.
Mm.
So I chased him out and I said, hi, my name's Stuart McGill. I'm playing my first test. And he said, you know, I know who you are, son. Well bowled today. And then he said, my God, your grandfather could play. And I thought that was sort of even more important to me than him telling me that I'd bowled well, because I think people who show respect to your family are obviously the respectful people, you know. And I think because too many people, especially nowadays, try and be smart when they're saying things like that, and I used to smash your dad or so, you know, like, yeah, you know, out, you know, hit the ball around. I think I just don't see the point of that. I mean, always go out of my way. If you see a former teammate with his children, you know, you bring up a special moment that you might have had together with them, or, you know, because people are proud of their family and there's no reason to have a go at them for that. And I just thought it was really cool when Bradman said that. And then my dad came shortly after me, followed me, and he straight away said, g'day Terry, how are you going? So I thought that was pretty good.
Great story.
I think it's a good story, but it also just shows that he was certainly a man of protocol and it was very polite, and it made that first test even more special. You're right.
So, third generation of first-class cricketer, I'm guessing it must have been, speaking of family, it's a really big thing for your family that you played for Australia and got the baggy green, the third generation along, you know, made it to the highest level.
Yeah, look, everybody said that Grandpa probably would have played for Australia had it not been for the Second World War. Mm. But they weren't playing much then in WA anyway. And I think my parents used to come to most of the test matches I played all around the world. And I think they kind of liked touring because cricket had been such a big part of their lives as well. Mm. So touring had, it was kind of a good way of, you know, meeting people of, you know, like-minded people and stuff like that. They got on pretty well with all the other parents that used to travel around. Me playing for Australia, unfortunately, I don't think my grandpa was around. No, he wasn't around then. But I know that would have, you know, it was pretty cool. He came to my first game for New South Wales. We flew over from Perth. Yeah, look, I think the fact that my family had been a big cricket family in WA, my grandpa's brother, so my great uncle was a chairman of selectors and a vice president of the WACA for 25 years as well. And I my dad had coached first grade teams for over 20 years. It was quite a big deal for our family, and I guess so. It's kind of cool that and maybe fitting that the effort put in by my family, not by me, but by my family, was sort of rewarded at some stage with a bag of green. You know, who knows? Maybe my son will get one too and outshine us all.
Yeah. Well, does he play cricket?
Yeah, he wasn't allowed to bowl spin. But
you made sure.
Made sure, no spin bowling. But he's a left-arm seamer. He bowls pretty well, but he's only 15. So, who knows? I think you'd be a lunatic to try and forecast the future in cricket, because there's so many guys who are 16, 17, 18 years old who are going to beat the world and then, you know, don't even play cricket when they're 19, 20. So, but he seems to love it at the moment.
At least he likes it.
He likes it.
You can talk about it. My son hates exactly cricket. Right. Yeah. So frustrating. Absolutely hates it. Okay, so you get the bag of green, you play for Australia. How is playing for Australia different to how you thought it would be?
Well, I don't think it was difficult. I don't think it was different. I mean, I think it was difficult, and I expected it to be difficult, and I think that that's probably what you expect from international sport. You know, if it was easy, then it'd be a lot harder to get in, a lot easier to get in which case probably people would give the game up. Mm. I think the achievement makes it worthwhile. Getting there makes it worthwhile, and then the pride that you get from doing well in a particular match is amplified by the fact, you know, sheer virtue of the fact that, you know, not very many people can do it. So it was very difficult to play, but I certainly don't think it was anything unexpected. I probably didn't expect to get so tired, maybe. You got mentally very, very tired, the weight of expectation, because you're not necessarily aware of that when you're out in the middle, because you're concentrating on what you're doing. You know, you're very, very focused on your job and performing. You don't realise you're concentrating so hard, and then consequently you don't realise how absolutely spent you are.
It looks like Steve Smith at the moment, the way he's looking now.
I think that's why sometimes you need to have people step in. I know Steve pretty well, and there's no way he would pull out of a series, but I think it probably wouldn't have been a bad thing for him to have been rested for the entire one-day series. And, you know, people who say, well, you can't do that because crowds are expecting to see Steve Smith bat. Well, if you want to see Steve Smith bat, we have to give him a rest every now and then, because otherwise he won't, because he'll just fall to pieces.
Yeah, I agree. And I think maybe they were hoping they'd win a couple early, the Aussies, and they could perhaps rest him.
But that would have been even been worse, because if they had won a couple early, then the pressure on him to complete the series would have been even greater. Mm. And you probably would have, you know, run the risk of doing even more damage. I was very surprised to see him finish, to be honest. But anyway.
Yeah, so when you made the Australian team, what was the environment like? Rumours surfaced that it wasn't always the greatest dressing room, you know, like any dressing room. Did you ever sort of feel that, or was it a good, supportive, welcoming environment?
Well, I don't remember anything being bad, to be honest. You know, when you were asking that question, I was trying to sort of think ahead. I don't remember anything. Mark Taylor was the captain, and there was certainly nothing anxious while he was captain, or Steve Waugh was captain for that matter, and I don't seem to remember that. I think some people on the outside expect you to be hanging out of each other's pockets 24 hours a day. Well, that's just crap. I mean, I just don't. everybody who goes to work in a 9-to-5 environment, they it's 9-to-5. Yeah, it's not then 5
hang
to
out with your friends. Know,
that's exactly right. So, I mean, we didn't spend 24 hours a day with one another, but we got along outstandingly well. You know, I mean, the majority of my test matches were with Steve Waugh, and I'd say that team environment was as solid as any that I came across, to be honest. I mean, you don't have to be like one another. You respect the fact that everybody in the team had the same goals. Mm. We all wanted to win, and none of us were... I certainly don't remember anybody being precious, because we wouldn't have allowed that.
Yeah.
So I don't think that it was... I don't think it was...
It's interesting you bring up Steve Waugh, because he said, I guess, how it wasn't a welcoming environment when he came into the team in the mid-'80s.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it started to shift, and he really wanted to make players feel welcome.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I don't know how old you think I am, Andrew, but it was... No, so because I came in towards the end of the 90s, so maybe things just had changed. I don't remember having any trouble at all, to be honest. And Steve in particular, every single tour, he would spend, you know, a couple of nights one-on-one with each player just to get to know them a bit better and just to make sure that, you know, the environment was a lot warmer. It was good. And then you would be left to your own devices. I mean, there's no hand-holding, but it's a test match. If you've got the ball in your hand, you're absolutely by yourself until you let go of it. And then you need the fieldsman. But, you're by yourself. You know, nobody's going to help you put it in the right spot. And if you bat, you make a mistake, you're out. So it's not really the sort of place where you can be mollycoddled, because it's particularly exposing. So, but he just makes sure that everybody in the team was on the same side. And we were.
Yeah, and I guess you played under Mark Taylor, Steve Waugh, Ricky Ponting. What did you learn from those skippers?
Well, you know, I guess I did learn that, you know, there's different stages to everybody's career, because probably Mark Taylor was the perfect captain for the beginning of my career, because I didn't really know what I was doing. And so he did lead me in the right direction, told me what he wanted me to bowl, told me how often he wanted me to bowl it. And then by the time Steve Waugh came on, I didn't really need that anymore. I just needed to know that everybody was sort of in my corner. And that's pretty much what we did. I mean, recognising the fact that all the bowlers were slightly different personality types, but we all, you know, we're all still friends. The bowlers probably are a pretty tight group of people. As you probably saw, there's a great photo on Instagram and Twitter after this series, after Australia had won the Ashes, of all of the bowlers. I mean, it's the greatest bowling group probably in living memory. You can talk about, you know, Lillian Thompson, who, you know, great, the West Indian four, but we had three, four great quick bowlers and Nathan Lyon that in one team at one time. It's an amazing, amazing lineup. Probably the only team that would get close would be, you know, a McGrath, Gillespie, Warne, and maybe Fleming, or chuck one of the, you know, Brett Lees in there. That's a pretty good lineup as well. But those teams didn't get beaten either.
No, and a second spinner perhaps.
Maybe.
Well, let's talk about Shane Warne, because let's get it out of the way. You so often, it seems like your careers are talked about together because you played at the same time and you had phenomenal success together. You played 16 tests. I think you only lost two of the 16. So when you played together, you were really great bowlers. I guess how long did it take you to realise that you were often going to get mentioned together, you know, and linked in that way?
Oh, well, it was happening before I played, because, you know, once Warne had established himself, which you know, as we know, didn't take long, you know, maybe a series, if you bowled leg spin anywhere in Australia, then you were compared to him. So that never really bothered me. And as I said to you, I never really compared myself to another bowler, because you can't win. If you, you know, there's no way I couldn't be as good as Shane Warne, but I just did what I did, and I could do that as well as anybody going around. So that's what I just tried to do. It doesn't really bother me. I mean, I think it's a little hard on people that have played, you know, subsequent to his retirement, because, you know, I had the opportunity of being compared in the same environment, on the same day, on the same playing field, whereas every single player who's played since, that doesn't get that opportunity. as I said before, I enjoyed playing with, you know, with him and McGrath and Gillespie and Lee, and you know, we you can't complain when you've got guys like him down the other end. And you know, I think the shame for me is that, you know, as you mentioned, we only lost two tests. I'm pretty sure they were both in the West Indies, and it was because Shane was injured. Or just coming back from injury, I think it was. I think he'd just come back from a shoulder injury. So, you know, he was just a bit rusty. And we had Brian Lara as the greatest player of spin bowling, full stop. And the stats sort of show that. So I don't mind being compared favourably to him or even unfavourably. You know, all I have always done is I went out there, tried to get as close to 5 wickets as I could per test match, and I did. So that'll do me. I'm happy.
Yeah, sure did. Did you want to play more together? Was that something that frustrated you?
Oh, look, I did. I think it's been widely documented that Shane didn't. I don't know why. It doesn't really bother me. The reason for me wanting to was because I reckon you pick the best 5 bowlers and then you win most of the games. You know, there were several times during, you know, my career where, you know, a seamer was preferred and we lost the test match. As you said at the top of this, you know, we didn't lose test matches together. So 2 out of 16 is a pretty good record. And quite often, you know, we would take 2/3 of the wickets or 3/4 of the wickets between us. So we were a pretty potent bowling lineup when both of us were playing. And I thought it was narrow-minded of, you know, the selection panel to overlook that, particularly when, you know, test wins were on the line. You know, the last test in the 2005 Ashes series, if we took 20 wickets, we won the test match and retained the Ashes.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big gamble, I reckon.
Yeah, big gamble. So let's leave all that behind. I just have so many fond memories of you playing at the SCG. I think you played, maybe you took 5 wicket hauls at the SCG.
Yep.
Is it still a magical place for you when you're here? Well, I mean, we're here recording now, but when you sort of go out and see the ground, is it still hold something special in your heart?
Yeah, look, I come here 2-3 times a week for, you know, various things. I'm on the trust at the SCG, which is great. So I'm involved, I guess, in an administrative capacity in that regard, and I coach here various players from various teams. So I am here a lot. It kind of feels very comfortable for me, as I, you know, played most of my cricket here. But it's a good environment. When I walk out on the field, I, you know, played a game for the SCG 11 a couple of weeks ago. Walking out onto the field, it still, you know, feels pretty familiar. Have a bit of a look around. The new stand's great. The pitch is very, very good. We're just lucky to have got a couple of great new curators and ground managers on board here now. So they're doing a great job. And I just sort of think that this place is being treated with the respect it deserves. The changing rooms are still the same.
Yeah.
which is fun. But
I love in the away dressing room how they have those two little rooms from throwback to when the amateurs and professionals used to come from England.
Yeah, it's surprising that they still got that there, but I guess it's a good talking point for touring groups that come.
Because they work out who's going to be in which room.
Who are the posh kids and who are the bogans. But we enjoy coming back here. All former players enjoy coming back here. We don't really spend much time in the changing rooms. It's kind of a thing that you don't really do all that much because you know how tiring Test cricket is, and you don't try to like stay out of the way of players when they're playing. But you know, I still get along great with, you know, because particularly the young bowlers in the team are all from New South Wales, so I know them all pretty well. So you see them. I'm down with the you know, the New South Wales team quite often, so it's quite good to stay in touch with everyone.
Do you still love cricket?
I'm enjoying working with bowlers and actually talking with the batsmen about the bowlers too. I think probably the talking side of things has been forgotten a little bit. Lots of senior players, that's what they used to do. They used to sit around and talk about things that they'd been through and difficult situations. Cricket, it's not an easy game, particularly, you know, 4-day cricket, 5-day cricket, when you've been at it for 3 days and you can't see a win. It still doesn't mean you're not going to win. And those sorts of situations are when experiences come through, and I'm enjoying talking with, you know, young bowlers and as I said, batsmen about that, and just maintaining a focus and, you know, setting up routines for particular, you know, times during the game. It's good, and it seems to be making me happy too.
And that's your way of engaging with the game still. That's
yeah.
The level.
Yeah, look, I don't really want to coach a team, but I like working with bowlers. So, and maybe captains. So it's just a good way. I guess, you know, the stupid you know, business word would be mentoring, but I don't really, you know, I don't think that's the right thing to say.
And how many bowlers even know what that means?
Well, possibly.
Fast bowlers.
Fewer
anyway.
Batsmen. Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with Stuart McGill. We're going to do a deep dive into leg spin, and I'm going to ask him about the current Australian setup.
Now McGill goes, he may hit a six, McGill, he has. Just so the man in the scoreboard can put the six next to McGill's name, he's hit it straight towards him.
You're listening to Cricket Unfiltered. I'm your host, Andrew Mentzel, and I'm here with Stuart McGill. And that was Stuart McGill hitting a six in the West Indies. David Hooks was commentating. I remember very fondly, not those sixes in the West Indies, but your 43 at the MCG in 98, 99. I think you shepherded Steve Waugh to 100. How did you enjoy batting at test level? Because you said he used to go out and just have a whack.
Yeah, look, the thing is that I really couldn't bat. So, and people say, well, why didn't you practice more and why didn't you spend more time at it? Well, the pure and simple reason is because I only got to where I was because I bowled so much. And, you know, every minute I'd spend in the nets with a bat in my hand was a minute less with the ball in my hand. And you probably would never have seen me bat if I hadn't done it that way, because I wouldn't have played test cricket. Mm. I probably wouldn't have played for New South Wales. So I obviously would prefer to have been a better batsman, because it's good fun. I think as a bowler, it's great fun hitting bowling, because you know how pissed off the bowler's going to get. But, you know, I think sometimes for me, I literally couldn't see the ball sometimes. So I don't know whether my eyes were dodgy, but, you know.
I can't believe you said that, because that's how I knew I couldn't bat, was when I faced Brett Lee in the nets and didn't see it.
Well, okay, you know, Ambrose, you know, there's just no way that you could, I just couldn't see.
Did you feel scared?
I was unsafe. Yeah. Because I didn't know where the ball was at all.
Yeah.
I had no idea where it was. I mean, the good thing about facing somebody like Ambrose is you knew that he knew where it was. So somewhere, you know, I mean, the ball was exactly where he wanted it to be. So that was reassuring.
Short of a length, into the roots.
Yeah, well, it was reassuring, but I didn't really see it. I think maybe sometimes subconsciously I picked it up as it had hit the edge of the bat, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't roughly, you know, I didn't have any idea what I was doing. So,
yes.
Look, it was cool. It didn't, I mean, I think I only hit two sixes in test cricket, so, you know, you can see how rare it was.
Well, yeah, that's why I put them in the podcast.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
I thought they were great moments.
Yeah, it's a great moment, yeah.
And that 40, but that 43 was a great afternoon at the MCG.
Yeah, it was good fun for me. As you said, Steve Waugh made 100. That was pretty cool. I watched it. It's a terrible, terrible innings. I think I only hit two balls in the middle of the bat out of the entire 43. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, it's on the boards now. So
that's it. And Steve Waugh got another test.
Yeah.
Ton. All right, now let's do a deep dive into leg spin. And I want to set this up. When I was coaching cricket a while ago, Peter Philpott came in, and he got around 20 young kids in a room. And he just got on his knees and he got a ball in his hand and he was flicking the ball out of his hands and just showing the different ways you could spin a ball, leg
yep.
spin, wrong, and all the top spinner. And he went through them all and the ball was darting off and the kids' eyes just lit up. You know, they were like seeing a magician, like
yep.
seeing something. They just couldn't believe what they were seeing. You know, so what is it that makes leg spinning so magical?
I can't tell you about the magic. I think that wrist spin bowling, the possibilities are just, you know, far greater than finger spinning. Finger spin bowling for me is something that batsmen do when they get bored in the nets.
Mm. Mark Waugh.
Well, pretty much. I mean, you know, I think he probably enjoyed bowling bounces more than he enjoyed bowling finger spin, but he could do it. He could do it easy.
Do everything.
And I think wrist spin bowling, you can, you know, because you can bowl balls that turn both ways and a top spinner. It's like playing tennis, really. You can make the ball go in any direction you like, really. And it's the top spin. You can get so much more top spin on the ball than you can bowling finger spin. Except for Nathan Lyon, who's just ridiculous. He can make the ball talk like a wrist spin bowler can. But I think that's pretty much it. And sometimes when you really get plenty on it, you can hear the ball going down the pitch too. And you can literally hear the ball as it's coming towards you. And that doesn't happen very often with finger spinners. And I think that can be mesmerising for a batsman too. And, you know, I've seen Peter Philpott do his thing and I can't do that. But that's okay. Everybody does their own sort of different things. But I think kids like to see, well, and spectators alike, you know, like to see extreme pace. They like to see swing bowling. If you can make the ball swing both ways, they like to see spin.
Yeah.
And then sixes, of course. But, you know, everything else in between is just a waste of time as far as I'm concerned. Medium pace bowling or, you know, just people that nip the ball around, I just find it boring.
Yeah. I don't want to upset all the medium paces.
Let's upset them. They're all rubbish. Yeah.
I think one thing about leg spinning that is sometimes, if you haven't ever seen it up close, is how hard it is. How difficult it is to land the ball and get it all in the right place.
Look, I think that the reason that it's difficult is that there are so many different things going on. So there's a huge amount of rotation of your body. So everything's going in one straight line, but then you deliberately rotate your wrist, rotate your body, taking it away from that goal, which is the batsman. And that means that there's a fair chance you're going to bowl a full toss or a half tracker. And the only person that didn't was Shane. Everybody else, they're battling their own bodies for, you know, large parts of the game. You know, biomechanically, Shane just had a gift. But by the same token, I think that rotation was probably what made me, you know, a little bit better than I could have been otherwise. If I'd cut that out, then I might not have bowled a short one outside off stump, but it wouldn't have turned. So what's the point? In order for me to get the most revs on the ball, I had to rotate a lot, and I thought about it a couple of times, but then I just, you know, no, I'm just going to keep going for that best ball, best ball, best ball.
So you went for the big turner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not just turn, but maximum revolutions on the ball. And that, because that was how I was going to get wickets. You know, it might not happen if I bowled one of them, but if I bowled two or three or four in a row, then invariably there'd be a wicket at some stage.
Are there any days that stand out when it all just clicked, when you just felt like every ball was going where you wanted? It was just one of, you know, you're in the zone as a leg spinner.
I bowled, it's probably three or four. I bowled great against the West Indies in Hobart one year, and kind of wish I came on and they were already five or six down, and I ended up getting four. But if I'd opened the bowling that day, I
could have 10.
Well, no, but I could have got a good.
You felt like you could have got.
I could have got a good whack of them because it was, and I really did enjoy that. That was pretty good. There was a great game in the West Indies, which wasn't as quick as that. You know, like I think we bowled a lot. We might have even made the West Indies follow on. We're playing in Barbados. Steve Waugh was the captain. We won the test. I think I got 9 for the test match, but it was a good test match for me. The ball pretty much went where I wanted it to go throughout. The pitch was really flat, so it didn't, you know, whereas the one in Hobart was sort of exploding when the ball hit it was fast and hard, which is, you know, my favourite kind of wicket.
But you felt in the groove.
Yeah, it just felt really good.
Not surprised in the West Indies.
Yeah, it was good. You had to really work for your wickets there, actually, because the pitches are pretty slow. But if you get it right, then, you know, the West Indians traditionally didn't like spin bowling too much.
Especially not leggies.
No. You know, that was pretty good. They're probably, you know, two that really sort of grabbed me, to be honest.
Yeah, good. And what about the young leg spinners that you work with now? So you spent a lot of time with Mason Crane.
Yep.
From the English side, made his test debut at the SCG in the fifth Ashes test. I thought it was just a breath of fresh air to see a young leg spinner come into the game. He stopped a lot before he delivered to make sure he was comfortable with his delivery. Is that something you talked to him about?
Yeah, it is. Look, you know, we just watched the Australian Open on the in tennis on the TV, and in at a Grand Slam level, if a server throws the ball up in the air and he doesn't think it's right, he just lets it hit the ground, catches it and goes again. Absolutely no difference whatsoever. Bowling is a set play, same as a serve. Batsman doesn't get a go at it until I let him. And if you're running into bowl and you think, no, something's not quite right, you're a clown if you don't stop. And, I think it goes to show that he's a lot more mature than 20-year-olds normally are, because he was able to do that and get on with it, which is really, really good. I think he bowled really well. It's just a shame. I thought the English seamers let him down, let themselves down too, more importantly, throughout the series, if I'm honest. I just think they lacked penetration and, you know, unfortunately for England, they probably just needed one of those senior bowlers to really stand up and let it go. For a 20-year-old kid to be bowling a quarter of the overs for his team in his first test match is a pretty big deal. I thought he did a good job. It's, you know, it was great that Mason did make his debut, because I know how hard he's worked. And, I was given the opportunity to work with him courtesy of the ECB. They've got a program whereby they send players that are underneath Lions level. So you've got the English team, then you've got the Lions, and then underneath that, so they're normally guys that are playing county firsts and seconds. Some, they're not necessarily established firsts.
And are these spin bowlers or all types?
They send players, batsmen, bowlers, keepers, everybody out, but I've got spin bowlers. We started doing a little bit of work with the wicket keeper. There's a wicket keeper out here this year too called Ollie Pope. He started to come to training now with us once a week. It's great for my guys to bowl to a keeper as well, and he's a great batsman too, so he's from Surrey. But what happened last year was Matthew Critchley and Mason Crane came out and they were playing, and they were both sort of in and out of the team for their county sides. Mason's at Hampshire, Critch is at Derby, and they come out and they play club cricket here, and then we train two or three times a week. So the good thing about that is when most of our sessions are done after a coffee, I think it's important to get to know the guys that you're working with, get a working relationship. It means I can be harder on them because they know they trust me. They know I'm not sort of just being nasty or
hassling them because they're bums anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Or an ugly, being an ugly school teacher or something like that. But it's really good. You establish a good working relationship with them. And I think it pays off in the long run. This year, there's four or five of them out here. Two of them have been picked to play in the North-East South game, the beginning of this English summer, which is a big game for them. And Matt Parkinson's been picked in the A in the Lions tour, which is great. Mason's over in the West Indies, I think now maybe, playing red ball cricket for the Lions. Then he's coming back to play, to be a part of the England side in New Zealand. I'm going to be starting to work with Ish Sodhi from New Zealand now too, yep, which is great. And the New South Wales spin bowlers, Dan Fallons, is doing a great job. And so I'm hoping
What about Lloyd Pope?
I saw Lloyd Pope's performance over in...
He had a wrong end that sort of almost matches yours.
Oh, I think it was probably better than mine. But, I think the thing that's very, very important that we've got to remember with young spin bowlers is how difficult it is. And to get eight for in a match like that, in an environment like that, against England, that was a pretty high-profile match, even for junior cricketers. So that's a spectacular performance. And I just think we need to make sure that we treat him with kid gloves, because it's not an easy thing to do. And I think he's going to get smashed from time to time, and we need to know that that's okay. It's not about the bad balls, it's about the good ones. And he's certainly got them.
Yeah, it's interesting at that under-19 level, the differences in experience of the young players, that English team just wouldn't have faced a lot of leg spinners, whereas the game after he plays Afghanistan, who have faced a lot of spin, so played him a lot differently, a big difference.
And also when you're on top, it's, it doesn't really matter how much you've faced the spin bowler. If you come out to bat and, your team's 3 for 20, you're going to play him differently than if they're, 3 for 300. So I think as long as we know that it's a learning experience for him and, he should be treated well, we know now that he can win matches for his team, and that should be the bit that we focus on.
Hopefully SCG Ashes Test 2022, Crane v Pope.
Well, I don't really mind. I don't really mind who's playing. I'd assume that Mace will be in there, because he's away now. Once you've got that first test match out of the way, provided he keeps improving the way that I think he can, he's he's determined with the bat, and he's, you know, very, very, you know, attentive in the field. I think he's got everything that he needs to play Test cricket.
He's got a great personality. He's got a really good personality. After one of the days of the Test, he was funny. He was self-deprecating, but he also had the strong will to say, "If I'm not ready to bowl, I'm not going to let it go." Yeah. So you put all that together, it's a pretty good package.
At 20, you know, which is just insane, really.
And what do you think about the state of leg spin in Australia?
Look, I think we're probably not concentrating enough on... Look, I think if you're a good first-class bowler, then T20 is easy, because your best ball, the hardest thing to do when you're playing in a test match or in a shield game is to get the batsman to play a shot. We just completely removed that from the equation in T20s and 50-over games. And I certainly enjoyed playing both for that very reason. The problem is when the bowlers get confused about their role and think that they've got a bowl wrong and's angling into leg stump. Well, that's actually going to hurt you in the long run. You might only go for 7 and over, but I'd much rather you get 3 for 30. If you get 3 for 30, your team's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think somebody like Ish Sodhi's been doing so well around the world. You know, I mean, I think most of us remember him playing against the Thunder last year.
Six for nine.
It's amazing.
Amazing.
You know, so, and that just ruins a game. And I want match winners in my team. The best teams I ever played in, 11 blokes could win the Test match or the one dayer or the T20 for you. And that's when you know you've got a really good team. Because you need to be able to rely on every single player in the team to win you the game. And a guy who's just going to, you know, take care of economy rates, not winning anything.
No, and I guess the funny thing is when T20 cricket started, everyone thought it would be the death of spin bowling. And in fact, spin bowlers
dominate. But I have to say now I'm starting to worry a little bit about, you know, you've got a guy like Yasir Shah from Pakistan who, you know, I think is fastest to 100 wickets. And now I think he's really, really struggling because he's bowling now, as I said, he's angling into a right-handed batsman, 3 or 4 balls and over a wrong-uns. He's bowling flat and fast. And I don't care what the commentators say. That's not actually the way to go about it. The principles of taking wickets remain the same, no matter what format of the game you're playing in. And if you're just trying to shut down a batsman, then you're on a very, very slippery slope.
What do you think of Rashid Khan?
Same thing. I think his best balls, though, are what he should be concentrating on, because he is wicket taker, he is match winner. His best balls are quite often a little bit slower.
Yeah.
And in a 20-20 game or a 50-over game, I can't see any reason why he wouldn't bowl more of those.
More wickets.
Yeah. Well, I genuinely think more. Because you're still able to deceive. You can deceive the batsman with change of pace just in a lower pace width, a lower you know, pace bracket.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be 88 to 92. You know, it can be 78 to 82. You know, I think that's the mistake that all of them are making now. But, you know, you've got to congratulate, a kid who's been around a lot and played a lot of cricket now, and he's still taking wickets. So that's pretty good.
Do you like watching leg spinners?
Depends. I like watching him with the sound down. The commentators drive me nuts, but I don't think I'm alone there.
I should get you in for the commentary critique segment.
Yeah.
That's one of the most popular segments on the podcast.
I can imagine.
Now, so we touched on your retirement before. When you came off the field in 2008 after the drawn second test at the North Sound Ground in the West Indies, did you know that would be your last first-class game?
No, I didn't. I was planning to come home and play for New South Wales. I thought that the problems that I was having were largely due to travel burden going to the West Indies. I had surgery a lot the season before.
On what part of your body? Everywhere.
Ankle, knee, wrist, jabs in my shoulder, jabs in my elbow. But
that's a lot.
Yeah, it was bad. But I just assumed that once I came home, rest, back in the gym, I'd be okay. But it just didn't. It just didn't happen, which was a bummer, and it actually, you know, still sort of drives me nuts, to be honest. Because I wasn't ready to finish. I wasn't ready to finish. So, but I just can't. I couldn't do it anymore. And obviously now I'm too old. But I it really did annoy me.
And I wish that I had been able to keep playing, even if it was just for New South Wales. New South Wales is where I'd done the majority of my bowling, and I had a great time for New South Wales, a good bunch of guys, and I loved playing here. Yeah, it was just a shame. And, you know, my last game for New South Wales, we won the Shield, so everything was sort of going pretty well there. But, you know, that was just the way it went.
Yeah, but I guess what you say is that you didn't ever have that sort of moment where you could walk off knowing that it was the end. It was just didn't come back.
Couldn't come back. Couldn't do it again. Which, as I said, is still incredibly frustrating. It's not, you know, it's just a bummer. I didn't want to finish. You know, it was the only thing I was ever good at.
Well, so you finished cricket, then you've had a successful TV show. You've done radio. What is it after cricket that sort of keeps you going?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I've done a range of things, and probably that's a reasonable indication that I'm still sort of looking for what I like to do. I don't really know what to do. It's hard to, cricket takes up a lot of time, and it's just hard to find something that really grabs you. You know, I know certainly at the moment, I don't think anybody's ever got rich out of coaching. I probably should chase cash, but I don't. I don't really think about it too much like that, but I don't really know what I like doing. I mean, as I said to you before, I enjoy coaching because I enjoy helping blokes out. I think that to a large degree, cricket is being measured in terms of performances and paychecks, and when you're coaching guys who are on the cusp of playing first class cricket, so, you know, let's say 17 to 22, 3 years old, they might never make it in terms of test matches, but you can still get some pretty good rewards out of working with them. You know, I'm enjoying that part of it. I don't know, in 5 years' time, I don't really know what I'll be doing. But, you know, I still enjoy operating on the periphery of the wine industry. That's yep. pretty cool.
Is that just drinking? Or?
No. I'm involved with a couple of bars doing the wine for them, and that's good.
An award-winning show. I think it was called Uncorked.
Uncorked, yeah.
And has it been...
It's a long time ago.
There seems to be a new one out.
Oh, I don't know. I don't really worry about that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, as I said, I never compared myself to anybody when I was playing cricket. I don't really care about any other wine shows. Do the best I could when I had a hold of it. And, you know, yeah, we did two seasons of that. That was pretty cool fun. I think it was a bit expensive to make. It wasn't my paycheck, but it was expensive to make. Things are a lot cheaper nowadays with digital cameras and stuff like that. But I enjoyed that, although it was pretty full on.
Would you like to try radio again?
Yeah, I like radio. I think I like radio because, you know, I like talking, as you may have
perfect
guessed.
Perfect for podcasts.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's hard to finish a sentence sometimes, but apart from that, I like it.
Good. All right, we're going to take our last break, and then we'll be back with Love It or Loathe It.
What a good delivery. He's pushed it through a bit and a bit shorter. And Lara has gone for it for the pull shot that he plays so well and has played against leg spinners on many occasions in recent years. McGill is through him. Beautifully bowled. A quicker, flatter delivery. And it has hit middle and leg. It's spun from just outside off stump. It has hit middle and leg about 6 inches from the top. That is splendid bowling. Lara gone for 17.
Welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp cricket podcast. Menas and Stuart McGill here. And that was, you'll be happier with this sound than the six. That was Stuart McGill dismissing Brian Lara at the Wacker in the year 2000. Richie Benno was commentating. You know, Richie Benno often said he talked to Shane Warne. Did he talk to you a lot? Did he help you?
Yeah. I think that rather than helping or anything else, Richie was a really good friend, a nice man. He's a really nice man. Mm. I think when you hear a young spin bowler on the TV, Richie would never say a bad word about them, was always excited for them and would always be talking about the sorts of things that they do well. And I think that warmth and that enthusiasm was probably what made him a great captain too. He always used to try and, you know, encourage everybody he was with. He was tough, I'm sure. I never obviously played under him, but he was always pretty good. And I think the reason I liked Richie the most was because he always had a little bit of a sparkle in his eye. You know, he's a fun guy, really, really good guy. So, you know, and I think, you know, Richie and, you know, Mrs. Benno, Daphne, they were a great couple. And, you know, I enjoyed his company and still enjoy hers.
I guess, you know, you spoke before about Brian Lara being the best player of spin.
Yep.
Did you ever bowl to Sachin Tendulkar?
Yeah, I bowled him a couple of times. I felt that Sachin wasn't able to tear you to pieces in the way that well, even if he was able to, he didn't try to tear you to pieces the way that Brian did. Brian would just go out there, and it wasn't just me. It was me, Warney, Kumble, Muralitharan. He had a real good red-hot go at every spin bowler he came across. So, you know, that was what made getting him out sort of, you know, even better, I guess. And he was pretty full-on. And he could hit the same ball five or six different spots, which was made it even harder.
Any other batsmen that you bowl to that you sort of remember as being just super talents?
Look, I think, you know...
Each state level even?
Yeah, or? Well, look, Lehman and Gilchrist were pretty hard to bowl to. Lehman particularly would just try and tear you to pieces as well, which was good. And I thought that Lakshman was pretty special. I liked getting his wicket. That was sort of felt really proud of yourself when you got him out. And Michael Vaughan taught himself how to play really, really effectively. He was a very intelligent cricket player, Michael Vaughan, and he worked out a way of going about things that reaped him, you know, great rewards towards the end of his career against wrist spin bowling too. So he was pretty cool.
Well, that's a pretty good list of batsmen. I remember watching Lara play spin at the SCG, and his footwork, and he did everything with such grace. You know, you talk about Tendulkar eased the ball to the boundary, but Lara would just smash, and beautiful swing of the blade. It was, you wouldn't coach someone like that.
No, you couldn't coach someone like that. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I liked him as well, because, you know, he saw the ball, he hit it. Much the same, you know, Steve Smith and, from all reports, Bradman. They just used to stand there, hit the ball in their own fashion, which, you know, which was pretty cool. And I think that that's something that people need to remember when they're coaching nowadays. You textbook's one thing, but the basic principles are what's more important, and that's, you know, see the ball, hit the ball.
Did you ever go out with Brian Lara?
Oh, yeah. I've been out with him plenty of times.
Good fun.
Well, yeah, he's got some good stamina.
Good stamina. He showed that with his 400 and his nightlife. All right. Now we're going to finish this podcast with a love it or loathe it. Love it or loathe it. So I'm going to.
They're my only two options.
They're your only two options.
Right.
Okay. Start. Day-night tests.
Love it.
The IPL.
Love it.
So doing so well. The ICC World 11 test that you played in.
Love it.
So good so far. Wavell Hines.
Loved him.
Yeah, so you dismissed him more than anyone in Test cricket six times.
Of course I loved him.
And last one is Steve Smith.
Love him. I guess I'm a lover.
You are a lover, not a fighter.
There we go.
There is a story that Steve Smith, in his first season as Sydney Sixers captain, told you to F off down to fine leg. Can you confirm that story?
Yeah, it's not exactly true. In fact, it's not true at all. He didn't say that at all.
Good, you've set the record straight.
Yeah, no, absolutely did not. But I did ask him if I could field somewhere else because I was running. It was only short fine leg, but at this stage, I was injured and carrying an injury. So running from fine leg was starting to cause me problems. And he absolutely did not say that, but he said that that's where I had to field. But that's okay. I think I took a catch off Brett Lee the next ball, so it worked out okay for everybody.
And did you see signs then that Steve Smith would go on to greatness?
Oh, look, you could see signs of his batting. I think his first – when he got picked for the Ashes tour, I just couldn't – I could not believe it. I think it was maybe 2009 or 11. He was nine, I think. He got picked for that Ashes tour, and I couldn't believe it. He wasn't bowling much, and he'd barely played a game. I was stunned. But he, and I told him this when he came back, he was the best batsman in the Australian team. I think he made 50 every single time he batted, certainly every match he played in. And I think it was something like maybe played 11 tests in a row, made 50 in every single one of them. So over the course of that 12 months. So I think that you know, and I mentioned that to him when I saw him immediately following that series. I just said, you know, I was surprised you'd been picked, but congratulations, because you know, if it wasn't for him, I mean, Australia got, you know, taken to pieces, but he did a great job. I think with the fielding, you see him in the field and he practices a lot. I mean, that's how I knew he was tired this series, because he dropped a couple of catches. You never see him drop a catch, ever. Not at training, never. So that's how you know that he's probably just really under a lot of pressure, and, you know, he responded great with the bat, and that's all we need him to do, really. But, yeah, no, he's a great player, and, you know, I'm sure that if we look after him, he'll be around for a while.
I hope so. All right. Well, Stuart, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been absolute thrill to have you on. Have you enjoyed it?
Oh, look, it's been probably one of the greatest days of my life, Andrew, to be honest. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Take care. I hope to see you around. I didn't want to say this at the beginning, but I really loved it when you played. You really used to light up the SCG especially. I have so many fond memories, and I really enjoyed coming to the box when you were celebrating that 12-er. It was a fun day, so thanks again. I was a lot younger then, and hopefully we can catch up soon.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and guess what? I do remember that.
You do?
I do.
Oh,